Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. A presidential request for a favor against a political rival, a whistleblower's shock, a secret memorandum, and finally, on Tuesday, an announcement by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
I'm directing our six committees to proceed with their investigations under that umbrella of impeachment inquiry. The president must be held accountable. No one is above the law.
President Trump says his call with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was, quote, perfect and beautiful. And he denies anything improper, pointing the finger instead at his congressional critics.
What these guys are doing, Democrats are doing to this country, is a disgrace, and it shouldn't be allowed. There should be a way of stopping it.
And earlier this week, 16-year-old Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg ripped world leaders at the UN over climate change.
We are in the beginning of a mass extinction, and all you can talk about is money and fairy tales of eternal economic growth. How dare you?
Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on the Twitters and Facebook at onpointradio. With us from the nation's capital, Eliana Johnson. She's editor-in-chief of the Washington Free Beacon. Eliana, congratulations on the new job, and so great to have you back.
Thanks very much, and thanks for having me.
And with us from somewhere else here in New York City where she's been traveling with the president is Paula Reed. She's CBS's News's White House correspondent, and she takes a special focus on the Justice Department and legal affairs. Paula, always great to have you.
Oh, great to be here.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, David, Eliana, and Paula.
Well, gang, I hope you all brought all of your bags because we got a lot to unpack today. Let's talk a little bit about the impeachment inquiry itself. We heard at the top of the hour Nancy Pelosi outlining the scope. Eliana, tell me a little bit about what you make of the formal proceedings themselves, what we should take from it.
Well, yesterday featured Adam Schiff presiding over an Intelligence Committee hearing that featured the Director of National Intelligence, Joseph McGuire. Democrats really pressing McGuire on why it took him a month to turn over this whistleblower complaint. McGuire saying that this the whistleblower complaint that outlined a conversation between President Donald Trump and the Ukrainian president may have been subject to executive privilege, and so he needed to go to the White House, and that has been the subject of controversy that he cleared this with the White House, and that the president could have exerted executive privilege over this and chose not to. But very clear, I think, that that House Democrats will impeach President Trump and that Senate Republicans are not prepared to remove him from office. So not much change after the hearing yesterday, but we did, I think, get to see that Democrats are going to narrowly focus their proceedings on this whistleblower complaint.
I want to drill down on that in a minute. We're going to talk a little bit more about specifics of the hearings and about what the president said about all this. But, Eliana, I want you to help us understand the precise nature of the inquiry. That is, you know, there are a lot of things that a lot of Democrats have said warranted investigation, warranted perhaps an inquiry for impeachment on. But Nancy Pelosi really wanted to bear down on this specific, right?
She did. I think Democrats are preparing to say that this whistleblower complaint outlines President Donald Trump asking a foreign leader, in this case, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, for assistance in his campaign. And they say it is illegal to solicit foreign campaign contributions. And they are considering this help in investigating Joe Biden's son, a foreign campaign contribution. And Pelosi thinks this is easy for normal people to understand, and that there was a cover-up in the White House. And outlined in the whistleblower complaint are this whistleblower alleges that White House aides took extraordinary efforts to put the call log of this call between the president, the American president, and the Ukrainian president into some sort of a special system that made it harder for lower, you know, mid-level or lower-level aides to access.
All right. Paula Reed, Let's talk for a moment about this, both as a legal and a political matter. You have covered justice and still do cover legal affairs. You are a lawyer yourself. This is a narrowly tailored impeachment approach. Is this a smart way to proceed, both as a investigative matter and as a reflection of political realities?
Well, the political reality is this is not what voters want. The polling is clear. Voters, especially they want Donald Trump to get out of the White House, they don't want it necessarily done through impeachment. They want it done at the ballot box. This certainly appeals to a certain faction of sort of further left members of the Democratic Party. But most voters, as reflected again in the polls, the numbers show they want Congress to focus on guns, on prescription drug prices, infrastructure. They don't want all the time and energy used on this. But this week, I mean, really the most significant thing is that this impeachment inquiry got the weight of the House Speaker behind it. Because really, in terms of procedure, we're not that much, we're not in a much different place than we were really last week. But now it has the House Speaker behind it, and it remains to be seen if they follow through on articles of impeachment. But there is a political risk here. But they're in a tough spot because you look at what happened here in the complaint. In the transcript, there are serious questions about the conduct here and potential high crimes and misdemeanors. And one of the most important things we have to remember, we're dealing with a Justice Department that does not believe that a sitting president can be charged. So the only repercussions for any illegal behavior on the part of the president or unethical behavior is really through impeachment.
Jack Beatty, what do you think about the way in which the speaker is approaching this?
I think it has risks and costs. I just want to emphasize those. David Brooks draws attention to the risks in the Times this morning. He says Trump will probably be acquitted by the Senate. He'll declare himself vindicated and victorious in his battle against the swamp. An ugly backlash could ensue in both parties. That's a real risk. And then the opportunity costs, Paula alluded to them. You know, the only way, it seems to me, we can get any action on guns is with a Republican president, because otherwise, with the filibuster, there'll be enough Republican senators to kill off any kind of safety measure, anything to bring some sanity to this madness. And there was a chance, a faint one perhaps, that perhaps a deal could have been made on guns, extending background checks, perhaps limiting the magazines and so on. Now we have Raymond James, the financial analyst firm, saying legislating is dead. Dead for guns, probably. And there was Nancy Pelosi this morning talking about prescription drug prices. Terrible. People with all sorts of conditions are paying, you know, being held up by these prices. And there's going to be no action on that, too. That's just two areas where the opportunity costs of this impeachment are going to be very high for just ordinary people.
You know, counterargument offered this morning by Norman Ornstein on Twitter, a frequent Trump critic, a longtime study of American government. He says, David Brooks' arguments against impeachment remind me of the arguments against the Iran nuclear deal. They conveniently ignore the consequences of inaction. No impeachment means we legitimize traitorous and corrupt acts by a president. I do want to turn to some of the substance of what we're talking about. Obviously, there's the question of whether the president of the United States used the power of his office, right, to pressure a foreign world leader to essentially harm a political rival by going after so far unproven allegations against the former Vice President Biden's son, Hunter Biden. In addition, it's striking, as Susan Glasser pointed out this morning on Twitter, to look at the headlines of the nation's three leading national newspapers. Whistleblower alleges cover-up. Trump GOP hit back as cover-up is alleged. That's the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post. The New York Times complaint asserts a White House cover-up. Paula Reid, let's talk a little bit about the accusation that this call between the two world leaders was somehow put on a server somewhere that would normally not be the repository of the records of a conversation between the American president and another world leader.
That's right. And that's where you get these questions of a cover-up. If the president had an improper conversation with a counterpart where he appears to be applying pressure for this individual to investigate a political rival, raises a lot of legal questions, one of which was possible campaign finance violations. The Justice Department looked at that, didn't conduct an investigation and said, look, we can't even assess what the value of this would be. We're not going to pursue that. But then you dig a little deeper and you learn that these conversations were put on a different server, which suggests, okay, why? Now, I'm going to give the White House their fair due. Their argument, sources inside the White House to me have been, well, we needed to start protecting these because in an unprecedented way, these were starting to leak. My question would be, what other ones went in that server? Was it North Korea? Was it Russia? Who else gets the special treatment? And the really concerning thing is it was lawyers directing White House officials to do this. So now we have some serious questions for the lawyers, because the lawyers traditionally in these other criminal investigations, when we've seen the president really start to overstep what is acceptable in his office, they've been the ones who have really protected him from his worst instincts. So here, if White House lawyers were directing White House officials to move these memos, these transcripts to different servers, the question is why? And we really don't have an answer, but it certainly raises questions about a possible cover-up.
I want to also ask a little bit about what we've learned. We've only got about a minute so left, I'd like to ask Paul and Eliana very briefly. The New York Times has published information about the whistleblower who brought things up, identified it as somebody from the CIA attached for a while with the White House. A lot of people, including the whistleblower's lawyers, have said, hey, this person's going to get named and named quickly, and there's going to be harm that could arise. Would you guys have – let's go with you, Eliana, first, your newly editor-in-chief. Would you have published that information?
I think it's inevitable that this person is going to become a national figure and their name and identity is going to become public. I think that this whistleblower probably knew that was the case when he came forward. The Times indicates this is a man. And sure, I think that there are some security concerns about this, but I think this person is also likely to be treated as a national hero by the left, I imagine. Television and book contracts are likely forthcoming. So while there are negatives surrounded with it, of course, we saw that during the 2016 campaign, where anybody who criticized Trump, Jews, and others were treated terribly. I think there are also some pretty big positives associated with it for this person.
Paula Reed, very quickly, yes or no?
Yeah, but I would have pushed for the interview. I don't just want the name in print. I want the interview.
You want the person's butt in a seat, and you want the interview.
I got some questions.
Broadcast reporter till the end. We're talking about President Trump, Ukraine impeachment, historic week in the news. I want my guests to stick around. Me, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're discussing President Trump and impeachment proceedings during this big week in the news. You can join our conversation. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I have an all-star panel of guests with me today. Eliana Johnson, new editor-in-chief of the Washington Free Beacon. Paula Reed, she's CBS News White House correspondent who focuses on justice and legal affairs. And our own On Point news analyst, Jack Beatty. As Paula mentioned a few minutes ago, the public has generally been against the idea of opening an impeachment inquiry. But as new polls from, I believe, Maryland and from NPR PBS have indicated, that number is rising a little bit. It may be Democrats coming home to a position they always would once somebody as prominent as Nancy Pelosi did it. It may be that the public is shifting a little bit more. We're not sure, but you're seeing a rise in recent days, and we'll see what effect the hearings have. We're very interested in your thoughts, and therefore I want to take a couple of calls that are coming in. Let's first go to Sarasota, Florida. Kathy, thanks for listening. What are your thoughts?
Hello. I am upset a little bit about the impeachment proceedings. Now, I know he's not a genteel man. Our president is a thug sometimes and a bully. That is taken for a fact, okay? However, this impeachment stuff is costing us money and time, and this Congress is wasting our time on all this, because I don't think he's against America. I thought that that one senator that says he's an agent of Russia is insane. Vote that man out immediately. Come on. Don't be absurd, okay?
And Kathy, can I ask you very quickly, two quick questions. Yeah. What party do you identify with, and who are you thinking of voting for, or who did you vote for at least last time around?
Okay, I didn't vote for any of them. No, I did not. But let me tell you something. I do believe that we need checks and balances on our president to a point, because he is sometimes unaware of what he's supposed to do in government. So he does need better advisors sometimes, and please control his Twitters. That is granted. However, the Democrats are showing their you-know-what. They're showing me how stupid they are, too. I mean, they're too stupid to run the place, honestly. If you really listen to them, they keep repeating the same question. They just want a chance to rant on TV. It's so obvious. Don't they realize we're smarter than that? Are you kidding me? I taught college math at 17. I'm not going to listen to these idiots.
All right. And this is no doubt what the remote control is for. I want to bring in another caller with another point of view, but strongly held from Sarasota, Florida. We thank Kathy for that. Joanna, thanks for listening. Thanks for calling in. Share your thoughts, Joanna.
Yes. Well, actually, I am on the polar opposite of that.
Sure.
Listen, I'm self-employed. And yes, I have a lot of concerns about healthcare, the environment, various things. But I got to tell you, the feeling from not just me, friends and family, at this point, we are beside ourselves, because this president has felt that he can do whatever he wants at any cost and is never held accountable. And I'll tell you right now, we were praying for finally the Democrats to do something to hold him accountable, because enough is enough. He is an embarrassment to this country. He is inept. He should not be running our country. I mean, I am so upset about all these revelations right now, and we need to hold him accountable. And the Democrats are not stupid. They're smart, because, you know, he runs our country, and he's running it into the ground. So that is my comment. And I represent a lot of us out there, a lot of us. So I don't know what the polling is showing, but they're not calling us. Okay.
Well, there seems to be actual real division at the moment. I want to talk a little bit about, Eliana, Paula, Jack, a bit about the whistleblower and what to make of this. Earlier this week, President Trump attacked the whistleblower, questioned his patriotism, asking the tweet, quote, "Is he on our country's side?" The acting director of National Intelligence, Joseph McGuire, said repeatedly in testimony yesterday before the House Intelligence Committee that he supports the whistleblower's right to come forward.
"I want to stress that I believe that the whistleblower and the inspector general have acted in good faith throughout. I have every reason to believe that they have done everything by the book and followed the law."
Now, obviously, as we've heard this week, the agency's inspector general ruled that the complaint was both credible and urgent in passing it along and wanting to share it with Congress. The president has been responding. So really, basically, at roughly the same time McGuire yesterday was testifying before the House Intelligence Committee on these very matters, President Trump was speaking to American diplomats at the UN. The Los Angeles Times posted audio of the remarks he made in private yesterday, in which the president explicitly attacked the whistleblower. Here's what he had to say.
"That person never saw the report, never saw the call, really never saw the call, heard something and decided that he or she, whoever the hell it is, sort of like almost a spy. I want to know who's the person that gave the whistleblower, who's the person that gave the whistleblower the information? Because that's close to a spy. You know what we used to do in the old days when we were smart, right? With spies and treason. We used to handle it a little differently than we do now."
"We used to handle that a little differently," sort of strained or modest laughter there. Paula Reed, you're a lawyer. How troubling is it for the President of the United States to say that about somebody who does have statutory protection under the Whistleblower Act?
it's fair for the president to attack this person as only having secondhand knowledge. That's just a good legal defense. But the fact is, many whistleblower complaints are based on secondhand knowledge. But then to accuse this person of being a spy suggests that they could be subject to the death penalty. That's just absurd. I mean, that is beyond the pale. We have to remember, who are whistleblowers, right? These are people who come forward with allegations of misconduct. And what makes a whistleblower different than a leaker is that a whistleblower goes through the proper channels. They go through the procedure. They go to the right officials. And most of the system is designed to protect them from retaliation. Because most people, if they're thinking about coming forward with something like this, they're worried about being demoted, being fired, losing a security clearance. So if you're a whistleblower, and we know this whistleblower's attorneys have said this person fears retaliation, you know you might get some of this blowback. But for the leader of the free world to suggest you may be executed, that's just beyond. And the real concern here is that this could potentially have a chilling effect on some other people who want to come forward with allegations of misconduct. But it's just so extreme. It also raises questions about just how worried the president is.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take that up, Eliana Johnson. You're editor-in-chief of the Washington Free Beacon, a chronicler of conservative thought, and you also used to cover the White House for CNN directly. You still have sources there, I'm sure. How worried are the people inside the White House about the implications of this, and how are Republicans on the Hill responding to this? We're not hearing a whole lot from them these days.
You know, one of the things that we've been hearing from the president is that impeachment is a bad move and that, you know, it's wonderful for him. I don't think that's right. You know, his lawyers are trying to fend it off. The president is really concerned about it. I don't think there's any president. Of course, there are only three before this one in history that have actually been impeached who would welcome impeachment. And but the president, you know, he always says he's a counterpuncher, and that's what he's doing against this this whistleblower. You know, it's absurd to call the whistleblower a spy or allege that this is an act of treason. The president himself has also been subject by some of his Republican challengers in the primary to allegations of treason in his phone call with Ukraine. I think that's equally silly, but you know, he is somebody who fights back hard and sometimes crosses a line, and I think he absolutely did that yesterday.
I mean, to score your point of how unusual this is, I think it's two presidents have been actually impeached, Andrew Johnson in the 19th century after Abraham Lincoln, and of course President Clinton was impeached, although not convicted. But Richard Nixon, of course, had to resign before it got to that point. He cut the process short. Eliana, you know, we're hearing these strains in Republican worlds mostly of, I haven't gotten to read it yet, from people on the Senate side, right? Sort of major Republican figures. And a couple saying it's troubling, we should learn more. Will Hurd yesterday, it seems to me relevant to point out, he's a Texas Republican. He's a former CIA operative. And he's also not up for re-election. He's decided not to run for re-election. He was one of the – I think the only one on the Republican side who posed substantive questions about the nature of the scandal itself, right, rather than simply trying to play a kind of rhetorical defense. Where do you sense that Republicans on the Hill are in terms of their desire to hold tight to the president even if things get very tough?
You know, the most important Republican on Capitol Hill, Mitch McConnell, has been very quiet about this other than to say it would be ridiculous to impeach a president over this conduct. A few Republicans have said that they are concerned by these allegations. Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin said that while he didn't find the president's phone call to be impeachable conduct, he was concerned about the allegations that the White House was hiding the transcript. Mitt Romney, a Republican senator from Utah, has expressed concern. So there are Republicans who have raised concern, but they're few and far between. It really does seem that Republicans are sticking with the president for now. And I just would underscore that impeachment really is a political question. Politicians haven't adhered to the standard necessarily that the president broke a law, and so you have to impeach him. I think a lot of people in retrospect look back at the 1990s. It was clear that Bill Clinton broke the law. He lied under oath. And Republicans then said, you know, he broke the law. We have to impeach him. I think in retrospect, a lot of them wish they would have taken a different political tack and said what he did was bad, but Politically, we wish we wouldn't have impeached him. And I think the Democrats right now, they're pressing to impeach Trump. But maybe politically, they will look back and say, you know, we made the wrong move politically.
I want to turn to for a moment to some of the testimony about Joseph McGuire. You know, he was at once lauded by a lot of lawmakers. And at the same time, his handling of this was really challenged by a number of Democrats. And the way in which he handled the whistleblower complaint. Here's Adam Schiff, the chairman of House Intelligence Committee, questioning Joseph McGuire, who, as I said, was the acting director of National Intelligence.
I'm just trying to understand the chronology. You first went to the Office of Legal Counsel, and then you went to the White House Counsel?
No, sir. No, we went to the White House first to determine, to ask the question.
Okay, that's all I wanted to know is chronology. So you went to the White House first. So you went to the subject of the complaint for advice first about whether you should provide the complaint to Congress.
Paula Reed, this is an instance in which there is a law that says within X number of days you shall provide whistleblower complaint if it's judged to be urgent to the relevant committees of Congress. And that wasn't done. It was delayed here. Schiff said, you know, we don't know if we would have gotten it if I hadn't essentially subpoenaed it. Right? How consequential is that? Or is McGuire right in a sense of saying, hey, I was working on it. It took a little longer than you might have wanted, but it all played out.
Look, I'm going to come to McGuire's defense here. I think Adam Schiff really misplayed an opportunity here. Director McGuire is not the villain in this story, right? He's effectively a high-level bureaucrat. He was working in the system, totally unprecedented situation. We have an inspector general of the intelligence community with a complaint about the president. You have executive privilege. You have confidential information. It's incredibly confusing. I've talked to different legal experts, and yeah, he did the safe thing. He could have done maybe the braver thing and not bring it to the White House. But when there's issues of executive privilege, I don't think you can really fault him for going to the White House to try to hash some of that out. So he didn't find himself on the wrong end of the law. But here yesterday during this hearing, Adam Schiff kept getting so in the weeds about the process. I think he was trying to lay some sort of foundation for obstruction, but I don't think that's what McGuire was doing. And if you're a person at home, you know, making dinner or lunch, I guess, at that time of day, you don't know. You haven't read the complaint. You don't know. Adam Schiff missed an opportunity to read the actual allegations in the complaint, allowed him to get into those. He got so bogged down in this question of where the complaint should have gone. Serious questions for Attorney General Bill Barr. But I think when it comes to McGuire, there is a pretty nuanced explanation for why he went to the White House first. And that's because there were issues of executive privilege. The White House, they're the only ones who can waive that. Well, other people will say, why would you take allegations of misconduct to the White House? They're the ones being accused. Look, it's complicated. We're in uncharted waters. And I think Adam Schiff spent way too much time on this yesterday.
I want to give Acting Director McGuire his due and let him talk for himself on this. Here's what he had to say to Schiff at one point. And McGuire repeatedly emphasized the unique nature of this particular whistleblower complaint when explaining his approach.
I appreciate that in the past, whistleblower complaints may have been provided to Congress regardless of whether they were deemed credible or satisfied the urgent concern requirement. However, I am not familiar with any prior instances where a whistleblower complaint touched on such complicated and sensitive issues, including executive privilege. I believe that this matter is unprecedented. I also believe that I handle this matter in full compliance with the law at all times.
And let's be clear, when he's talking about executive privilege and the unprecedented nature of this, he's in effect saying, we didn't expect to handle this when the person being accused of the rogue actor is the president himself. Jack Beatty, we heard from Ilya Johnson about Republicans and political fallout and how impeachment takes on these things. Let's talk about what this does for the 2020 race. How does this affect Trump? How might it affect Joe Biden?
Well, about Joe Biden, you know, right from the start of his career, he swore, he said, I will not have stock. He never owned stock. And he put such money as he had into sort of white elephants, these houses of his in Delaware, because he had a big extended family. So he's been, and through those 36 years, he was consistently one of the least wealthy members of the Senate. And now he finds himself in the situation, and he will of having to defend himself against these smears of his son that Trump has raised that are without foundation, that somehow the whole business about the prosecutor in Ukraine who Joe Biden talked out of prosecuting his son, etc. That's a smear. What isn't a smear is the cushy cashing in that Hunter Biden, the kind of ne'er-do-well son, for $50,000 a month, he was served on the board of a Ukrainian energy company. He claimed that he never discussed this with his father, but in the New Yorker, he says he has his father saying, I hope you know what you're doing. You know, a president of the advocacy group Public Citizen says this about this. It's hard to avoid the conclusion that Hunter's foreign employers, there were others, and partners were seeking to leverage Hunter's relationship with Joe, either by seeking improper influence or to project access to him.
And presumably,
that's an incubus for the vice president.
And we'll linger on regardless of how this plays out for the president himself. Coming up, we'll talk more about President Trump's speech at the UN as well as the Climate Action Summit. You can join our conversation. We'll take a few calls about Ukraine and the president. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. In other news this week, Eugene Scalia, the son of late Supreme Court Justice Anthony Scalia, was confirmed as Labor Secretary. He is a noted skeptic in some ways of the value of labor unions. And former French President Jacques Chirac, who is an opponent of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, died at the age of 86. Now we're going to return for a little bit to talk a bit more about impeachment and President Trump, and we'll be talking in a few minutes beyond about the UN and about climate change. You can join our conversation. Follow us on the Twitters and Facebook at On Point Radio. I have, as I said earlier, a terrific panel of guests with me today. Eliana Johnson, the new editor-in-chief of the Washington Free Beacon. Paula Reed, CBS News' White House correspondent who focuses on Justice Department and legal affairs. And, of course, our own On Point news analyst, Jack Beattie. Jack had been talking a little bit about Joe Biden. Last night, the former vice president appeared on Jimmy Kimmel's show, and he basically said it seemed to him awfully hard to avoid the conclusion that what the president did was an impeachable offense and a violation of constitutional responsibility. Would love to take a couple of your calls now. Let's take this call from Joe in Oklahoma City. Joe, thanks for listening. What are your thoughts?
I think we just wasted 3 years on a bogus dossier investigating Trump for a bogus Russian collusion charge. Millions of dollars, Congress got nothing done. And now we're going down the same path again with the same cast of characters. We're going to waste our time on an impeachment to which I have yet to hear a specific charge or account for. And if you think the American people are stupid, not all of us are that dumb to go down the same path again and believe that there's any credibility to any of this. It's a waste of time. It's all politically motivated, and it represents the worst of the American system and basically socialist against our president. Time to take him down.
All right. Thank you for sharing your thoughts today, Joe. Appreciate it. Let's go now to Brookline, Massachusetts. Nick, weigh in here.
Hi. I was just going to say that I think it was a mistake in the approach that the Democrats made in the beginning of sort of going after the admiral in the way that they did. They need to be a little less passionate, a little bit more kind of humble in their approach, because I think the guy made an honest mistake, or he was honestly trying to do the right thing. And what ends up happening is you end up with people who you know, call into question the credibility of the Democrats, even in the face of what is clear collusion. Now, it's so clear. All you have to do is read it, you know, and it's
and
really
Nick,
clear.
Forgive me. In this case, when you use the word collusion, you mean that the president was clearly trying to pressure the Ukrainian president to weigh in?
On the Ukrainian president. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, not collusion, but an attempt to do so on mm-hmm. the Ukrainian president. Those guys don't want to hear it, but they're not going to hear it if the first thing they're going to be able to accuse you for is being unpatriotic because you're going after an admiral. You know what I'm saying?
Going after Joseph McGuire, the former Special Forces guy turned, intelligence official. All right. Well, thank you for that, Nick. I appreciate it. I want to, it does seem as though Joseph McGuire was, a guy very much trying to play by the rules and saying the rules were hard to apply here because he had, as he said earlier, an unprecedented set of circumstances. I want to go to another top official and think about that, Paula Reid. We're still learning a little bit about Attorney General William Barr's role in all of this. The president invoked the Attorney General in his conversation with Ukrainian President Zelensky, basically saying you should talk to him about the Biden thing. And I want to play a clip from May when Democratic Senator Kamala Harris questioned Barr during testimony on the Hill.
Has the president or anyone at the White House ever asked or suggested that you open an investigation of anyone? Yes or no, please, sir.
The president or anybody else.
Seems you would remember something like that and be able to tell us.
Yeah, but I'm trying to grapple with the word suggest. I mean, there have been discussions of matters out there that they have not asked me to open an investigation. But
perhaps they've suggested.
I don't know. I wouldn't say suggest.
Hinted.
I don't know.
Obviously, Harris is also a 2020 Democratic presidential candidate. Harris tweeted yesterday that Barr needs to come back to Congress and answer this question again under oath. Paula Reid, it seems to me fair-minded to say that with the evasive or elliptical answers being offered there by the Attorney General. At the same time, I'm trying to get a handle on the role that the Attorney General and particularly the president's private attorney, Rudy Giuliani, is playing in all this. Help us sort that through.
All right, let's start with Attorney General William Barr. The fact that the president repeatedly invoked the name of his attorney general in this conversation suggests to us that the president believes he has an attorney general who will help him, who will defend him, who will protect him. That's something he repeatedly disparaged his previous attorney general, Jeff Sessions, for not doing enough. And William Barr has given him good reason to think this. And we look back at the Mueller probe. Remember, Barr came out before that report was released with a statement, really spun it in favor of the president. I was there at that press conference. He sounded more like a defense attorney than an objective arbiter.
Somebody doing him a favor, to coin a phrase.
Exactly. Finally got his wingman. He often compares to Eric Holder and Barack Obama's relationship. He says he wants someone who he believes would protect him. So in this case, we know that William Barr, the Justice Department, they did not conduct an extensive investigation into these allegations. They also played a central role in blocking them from going to Congress. Now, as Democrats pursue impeachment, Justice Department is going to be under a lot of pressure to open a parallel criminal investigation and really look at some of these questions. That'll be a big test for Barr. Now, one of the people the attorney general may have to look into is the president's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani. Once again, we're in uncharted waters, unprecedented for a president's personal attorney to be out there doing this freelance diplomacy. He kind of appears to me to have turned, he's not so much an attorney to make legal arguments. He looks more like a fixer now that Michael Cohen's in prison. He seems to have taken over really that role. But if they look at bribery, Giuliani could have some exposure there because he's out there negotiating on behalf of the president. There are questions about how his travel is being paid for. Is he lobbying on behalf of foreign governments? Giuliani could really have some exposure here. But I know in talking to sources inside the White House, folks who are career attorneys, work on national security, they're extremely frustrated. He's going outside the chain of command. He is not helping. And at the end of the day, he's really exposing himself and potentially others to legal liability.
Last night on Fox News, I think it was with Laura Ingraham, he sort of held up these text messages, he said, that seemed to show that he was doing so at the behest and with the coordination of various State Department officials, essentially saying, I'm going to take these guys down. You know, I've got these guys if I get any trouble and I need this to protect myself. Very interesting language being used by such a former – such a prominent former Justice Department official, former U.S. attorney, former mayor of the city of New York. Jack Beatty, let's talk for a moment about – and turn now from the impeachment, from Ukraine. Now, to the substance of Trump's appearance at the UN this week. Obviously, the president was talking a lot about whistleblowers and impeachment from the UN, but he said other things too. He gave a speech to world leaders, global leaders, at the General Assembly in New York City on Tuesday, and he took a nationalistic tone.
Wise leaders always put the good of their own people and their own country first. The future does not belong to globalists. The future belongs to patriots. The future belongs to sovereign and independent nations who protect their citizens, respect their neighbors, and honor the differences that make each country special and unique.
Jack, what do you make of that address and the rhetoric driving it?
Well, you know, when Gary Cohn, the president's former economic advisor, resigned, I believe a year or so ago, more, there was a lot of discussion in the press after the president referred to him as a globalist. And Jonathan Greenblatt of the Anti-Defamation League and others pointed out that globalist is a code word, an anti-Semitic code word. It's heard that way on the right, and it has a lineage. You go back to the – well, we won't go back. We know that that's the case. The president still is using that word and still – signaling, I think, to those people, or I don't know how else you can see it because of all the publicity his branding of Cohn as a globalist raised at the time. The second thing we heard in the president's speech was he attacked the WTO for presumably being, well, not presumably, for being too friendly to China. Well, you know, here's the facts. Over the last 16 years, we have challenged Chinese practices before the WTO 23 times. The win-loss record, U.S. 19, China 0, with four cases pending. The WTO has not been an instrument of China, quite the reverse. It's consistently voted against China and for the U.S. in these trade disputes.
Eliana Johnson used to cover the White House, tracked the president pretty closely. It seems to me as though it's hard to argue with Jack's analysis in terms of how the word globalist is often taken, and with good reason because of its heritage. It seems to me this is kind of consistent with, in some ways, a slightly tamped down version of the way in which Trump embraces the idea of nationalism. At the same time, he's addressing world leaders. He's talking at the UN General Assembly, usually – even the more conservative American presidents that have gone there have extolled the value of sort of international cooperation, friendship, amity, collaboration. This seems like a president happy to essentially say we should stand apart and be, you know, almost good fences build good neighbors sort of thing.
You're right about that. I think President Trump is unique in the post-World War II catalog of American presidents, in that he genuinely doesn't view American alliances as part of what has made America strong. And he doesn't understand, say, that the Marshall Plan was a key element of building up American strength in the post-World War II era. And he this is a real part of his worldview. And so his view is instead to say, why are we paying to have American troops in South Korea? Why are we paying a disproportionate share of UN funds? Why are we paying more than our allies into NATO? Because he doesn't view these organizations as part of exporting American power, hard and soft, abroad, and genuinely doesn't have a strong belief in that, which I think has been a bipartisan belief among American presidents from Franklin Roosevelt on.
Let's turn now to an issue that is related in the sense that it played out against the backdrop of the UN here in New York City, but also is related in the sense of the ability of world leaders and world societies to work together for a common good that transcends borders. in the face of a lot of domestic political issues throughout. Greta Thunberg is that now famous 16-year-old Swedish schoolgirl and activist who's become a leader of the worldwide youth climate movement. She spoke at the UN Climate Action Summit earlier this week. Her voice quivering with anger, she called on today's adults, politicians, parents, CEOs, you name it, to at long last start acting on what we already know about climate change and not to abandon their own children.
How dare you pretend that this can be solved with just business as usual and some technical solutions? With today's emissions levels, that remaining CO2 budget will be entirely gone within less than 8.5 years. There will not be any solutions or plans presented in line with these figures here today, because these numbers are too uncomfortable. And you are still not mature enough to tell it like it is. You are failing us.
Paula Reid, that uncomfortable rhetoric and tough challenge to world leaders was also accompanied by a new report on the oceans, this fate of the oceans this week from the IPCC, which is sort of the consensus of world scientists and authorities on this. What's the standing? Like, what actual influence do these studies, has this activism hand on the way in which people in Washington think about this issue?
Well, let's take Greta first. I mean, I think it's an impassioned speech, but I'm not convinced having someone that age speak to people in the UN setting changes the hearts and minds of the people that you really need to get on board. The people who support her, likely already with her. Now, it's been interesting to watch the Trump administration. We know that the president made an unexpected visit to one of the climate change events there. He stayed briefly. He wasn't expected to go. But they've made this pivot. They're trying to say, look, we're not worried about climate change because the real problem is air quality and water quality. So there does appear to be a recognition within the Trump administration and likely the campaign that this is an issue, maybe not climate change specifically, but generally the environment is something that concerns voters, particularly moderate voters, folks that they would like to either retain or gather in the next election. So you're seeing a little bit of a pivot. But ultimately, I really think the president has been pretty clear. He does not believe in climate change. He's pulled out of the Paris Climate Accord. The administration has certainly not been a friend to environmental activists.
Jack Beatty, I'm going to give you the last word. We've got about a minute left. But it seems to me as though Greta Thunberg drove conservatives, Republicans nuts. And there are, you know, plenty of, you know, adults on whom that'll grate. On the other hand, there's something that at least in principle says to me, this is the world that children are going to inherit. And there's something inherently, you know, not unreasonable about thinking they may get interested in this issue. What did you take from the developments of what we saw over the past week, and whether or not you think it will continue to echo or just dissipate like so many other things?
Well, I think her jacques will echo through the years. I mean, you just can't, you know, China, the biggest polluter, made no new commitments at the summit. The U.S. was quiet. Other countries said little. And yet, I think this brave young woman essentially sent a message to the future. We care. You should care. And when she said, you know, you're talking about fairy tales of eternal economic growth, in 2018, a report from 13 federal agencies warned that failure to rein in warming could shave 10% off the country's economy in this century. In other words, she's right. She's saying it's a fairy tale that you can have economic growth without dealing with climate change.
And the latest report showing that the oceans are getting hotter and the oceans are getting hotter. I want to thank our panel, Ileana Johnson, editor-in-chief of the Washington Free Beacon. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, David.
And I also want to thank Paula Reid, CBS News White House correspondent. Thanks for joining.
Thank you.
And our own On Point news analyst, Jack Beatty. Jack, have a great weekend.
Thank you, David.
And listeners, before we go today, a note on a special upcoming broadcast of the show. On Point is hitting the road again. My colleague Meghna Chakrabarty will be in Columbia, South Carolina for a special On Point live show next Thursday, speaking with community leaders, journalists, and voters about 2020. South Carolina will play an important role in the election cycle. It's the site of the first Democratic primary in the South. So, On Pointers, we've got a request for you. Go to our website, onpointradio.org, and tell us more about what you want us to cover. Which issues are you most concerned about for the primaries? What kind of effect do you think South Carolina's primary should have on the national level? Again, you can let us know at onpointradio.org. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.